Well, this is Mark Dunley with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and we've been talking with Noreen McKee with the Just.
This is Otis M. Carson. I'm from NYC, and you're listening to WGXC Acra Hudson Catskill.
Turn out for Way Farms WGXE 90.7 FM's karaoke contest fundraiser at Half Moon in Hudson on Friday, May 10th. The evening will be hosted by karaoke Amanda of WGXC show Dim the Lights with Jenny and Amanda, with proceeds from ticket sales benefiting WGXC. The contest's theme is communication, so all songs related to dialing, radio, phone, internet, fax, and more are eligible. Choose your tune and sing it for our guest judges, Ariel and Gloria, of WGXC show Las Brujas Bilingües, and DJ Patty Boom of WGXC show Vinyl Freedom, to win prizes. Prizes include tickets to the Negative Land and Sue C., Matt Mose, and Rodney Allen Greenblatt show at the Greenville Drive-In and other goodies. Doors are open at 7 p.m. and karaoke contest begins at 8 p.m. If you can't turn out in person, tune in for a live broadcast of the event on the FM dial or online. For more information, visit the community calendar at wavefarm.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Bernsey's Multimedia Services, providing the Hudson Valley with a variety of video production services, including help to keep those wedding memories fresh. For more information, visit BernseyMedia.com or call them at 518-860-2751 or email BernseyMMS @gmail.com, BURNSYMMS @gmail.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Dave Freed in Cornwallville, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Ilan Pappé, the U.S. has no limits when it comes to Israel. The historian Ilan Pappé comments on the missile launch to Tel Aviv, the ICC ruling, and his own interrogation by the FBI. Ilan Pappé is an Israeli historian and political scientist. He's now a professor at the University of Exeter in the UK. His best-known book is The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, based on declassified British and Israeli government documents. The book explains that the expulsions of Palestinians were executed based on a plan drawn up in 1947 by Israel's future leaders. Ilan Pappé left Israel in 2008 after being condemned in the Knesset. A minister of education had called for him to be sacked. Frank Barra, the French activist, author, and film producer, and longtime friend of Ilan Pappé, spoke with him on his podcast on May 26, 2024. This was within days of the missile launch into Israel the International Criminal Court request for arrest warrants, and Pape's detention by the FBI when he arrived in Detroit for a speaking tour. Here's their conversation.
Hello, Ilan.
Hi, Frank. Good to see you.
We've been speaking every few months for about 10 years, but even more like in the last like 7 months. And I prepared this interview because I do prepare my interviews. And I wanted to start by asking you about what happened about 10 days ago in the U.S. in Detroit when you were interrogated by federal agents. But in fact, something happened a few hours ago that I maybe want to start with. And what happened a few hours ago is that Hamas and its military wing launched a pretty massive rocket attack on Israel. What's your opinion on this? Because if we listen to Israel, they've been carpet bombing Gaza for 7 months to eradicate Hamas. If you listen to Israel, Hamas and the Al-Qassam Brigade's military capacity has been really, really sort of damaged. But then Hamas shows that it looks like nothing of the sort happened. So what does it mean for the whole last 7 months, in a way?
Yeah, it has two sides to it, because the missiles were launched from Rafah. So on the one hand, Israel can concoct a narrative that says, you see, that's why we have to go into Rafah, the only place that we have not occupied. And that's what they are already saying. But you're right, there's something more profound here, and that is the military failure of Israel to defeat the Hamas in terms of its military capacity, its presence in Gaza. It's obvious that they have not fully understood until now how the Hamas is organized, structured, and so on. And their promises to the Israeli society that this is a feasible objective of the war. Not only that this kind of takeover of Gaza would be the main way of releasing the hostages. All this is crumbling down, definitely. So I think if until now a lot of Israelis lost their confidence in the Israeli army because of what happened the 7th of October, I think there's another reason why they would be a bit less confident in the army. And a lack of confidence in the army has, of course, more profound implications for the sense of invincibility, the lack of horizon in the future, the vision for the future. We already knew that you cannot uproot the Hamas as a political force, an ideological force, whatever the Israeli will do. But it seems that they're also not able to really uproot it militarily. So on the one hand, they will use it to ignore the ICJ ruling on Rafah. On the other hand, deep in the Israeli public, this would, as I say, erode the confidence, not only in the political leadership, but also in the military leadership.
Thanks, Ilan. You talked about the Israeli public. There is still this myth in Europe, or in like so-called liberal Europe, that the left exists in Israel and that there's a peace movement in Israel. We've seen lots of demonstrations in Israel in the past few months. Most of them call for the release of the hostages. A few of them call for the end of the war, but hardly, I mean, a very, very, very small group calls for, you know, the war being a genocide and for the end of the occupation, etc. Do you think there's a way that what's happened in the last 7 months, including what's happened today with Hamas launching rockets, including many hostages still in Gaza dying under Israeli bombing, do you think there's a way that Israeli society or a part of Israeli society could finally see that this goes beyond the army or beyond Netanyahu being a bad guy? Or have you also lost hope in Israeli society?
Well, it's a bit more complicated. I do think that the number of Israeli Jews who are willing to see the end of the war is much larger than it was 2 months ago. I still think the majority would feel that if, let's say, Netanyahu declares the end of the war, that it's a failure. And those who are his electoral base, those who are on the right, really the electorate that brought this coalition to power in November 2022 would still support very much an intensified military action in Gaza. The other camp, the more liberal Israeli camp, we cannot call it the left, of course, anymore, and it's more kind of center-right camp in Israeli political terms, I think becomes tired of the war, cannot see its purpose anymore. It's still a minority, but it's a much larger minority than was before. It's interesting that the narrative that the families and those who support them and those who oppose Netanyahu have, the narrative is, let's have a swap of prisoners. Let's stop the war. I haven't heard from anyone, let's stop the war because there's a genocide. Nobody says it in Israel. I mean, there are a few individuals who do, of course, and the Arabs of Israel say it. But you know, the vast majority in the so-called liberal camp, they say, let's stop the war so that we can bring the hostages back home, and then we can continue the war. I think that is what probably in Europe is so difficult to understand, that their reasoning for asking for a ceasefire is to bring back the hostages, which is fine, which is definitely a noble and justified request. But there is not even a modicum of compassion to the people of Gaza, which is really incredible if you think about it. And they would like Netanyahu to go, that is true. But again, I think both of us know that even if Netanyahu goes, Benny Gantz, Lapid, whoever will win, or might probably win the next election, I think Netanyahu might lose it, will continue the military actions in the Gaza Strip, would continue the harsh policy in the West Bank. But on the ground, I'm afraid that they have no plan B, they have no strategy, and therefore position in Israel is to Netanyahu, to the idea that you cannot stop the war for hostage swap, but there's no opposition to punishing, if you want, in adverted commas, all the people of Gaza and using similar methods in the West Bank and suppressing any freedom of speech for the Palestinians inside Israel.
When we spoke about 6 months ago now, so sort of at the early stages of the genocide, you told me that what was happening in Gaza was an incremental genocide. You know, you said at the time, Israel's not going to go with the atomic bomb and erase Gaza. They could, but they're not, because, you know, the international community would have to say, no, this is not right. They will go incrementally. You've been proven 100% right. But at the time, and seeing what's happened in the last 6 months, did you think Israel could go that far? Because we've seen some of the most horrific scenes and actions and bombardments and killings and torture I have ever seen in my life. I'm 47 years old, you know. Did you expect that Israel and actually the international community, and I'm talking about states, would let this happen at this scale?
I was surprised by the level of brutality. I mean, I expected a very brutal reaction after the 7th of October, but not at that level. I didn't really expect it to be a genocide of that kind. And similarly, I didn't expect that a genocide that is daily broadcasted to us on our small screen, our bigger screen, which we cannot say that we don't know. Nobody can say that they don't know. It's so visible in our screens, as I said. I didn't think that Britain and the United States in particular could adopt such a callous position and continue to immunize Israel. I mean, I understood the early reactions, you know, 2-3 weeks after the 7th of October, the kind of sympathy that European and American, European governments, United States showed to Israel because of what happened on the 7th of October. And I understood the discourse that they used of the right of self-defense. But that was before we understood what was going on in Gaza. The fact that this is still the discourse is incredible. And But if the international tribunals, legal tribunals, will be able eventually to have a powerful position towards Israel, it will not stop with Israel. It will, I think, be also about those countries that were complicit either by military aid or by their silence and support for these actions on the ground.
I'm going to talk about this now. So in the last few weeks, really, in the last few days, we've had the two highest judicial bodies in the world, the International Criminal Court, asking for an arrest warrant against Gallant and Netanyahu, which is historical because usually they don't go after so-called, you know, democracies or Western states. It's actually the first time they'll go. I mean, there's Putin, but I guess he's not considered part of the Western world. So this is historical, despite the massive pressures that Karim Khan has been under and has been facing, and the threats as well. You have the ICJ, the highest UN court, so the International Court of Justice, asking Israel now to stop its bombing of Gaza. You have Norway, Spain, and Ireland recognizing Palestine, I think, on the 29th, so it's in about 3 days, which I think will bring the number of countries that recognize Palestine to about 146. So a huge majority, and some others are coming. I think Slovenia is coming up as well. You have student occupations all over the world in the biggest universities in the world. You have more and more celebrities and people finally speaking out on Palestine and in support of Palestine. So, you know, I've been immersed in the Palestine question for nearly 20 years now. I have never felt myself that Israel has been that, in a way, isolated. What's your view on that?
Yes, I think you're right. This unprecedented level of isolation, there's no doubt. Let's start with the ICJ and ICC. We have to remember, unlike domestic legal systems, international legal systems are more susceptible to political influence. And there are two kinds of political influence you get when you are dealing in an international tribunal with Palestine. You have pressure from the political elites that would like you to continue provide Israel an exceptional position and treat it as a Western country, and therefore the ICJ and ICC should not deal with Israel. It is, as you say, it's only for Russia and the global South. But you also have the pressure, and they are fully aware of it, of the global South and the civil societies in the global North that demand that the governments will take a tough action against Israel. And there is the gap, of course, between the politics from above and the politics from below in the global North towards Israel. I think what the judges there felt, that they can narrow the gap and not only reflect the political elite's wishes on Israel, but also reflect authentically what the vast sections of the civil society around the world feels about Israel. And I think that's what they were doing. I think for many years they waited for the political elites to do this. They didn't want to be those who initiated actions against Israel. And that's why even a prosecutor that Israel and America demanded would be appointed felt that he has to respond not just to the legal question, which of course he did, but also to the fact that they represent the global world. They don't represent Western governments only. And so I think that's very important, despite many people would say there's some deficiencies in, they didn't mention genocide in the ICC and so on. Let's put all that aside. Basically, it's incredible compared to anything that happened before. And of course, it's not surprised that a country from the global South is the one that initiated the procedure. There's no way that even a relatively pro-Palestinian state would initiate such a process. So that's very, very important. Still, we have to see how it unfolds. What are the practical implications? They don't have much power of sanctions and so on. But nonetheless, I think historically, in the wider context, we will see it as a very important landmark in the movement, I think, towards sanctions towards Israel, because we have already boycott and divestment. And the students, of course, movement has helped to turn divestment into something far more widespread, practical, and convinced some of the university management to take action on divestment. And that's also something that didn't happen before. Not only that, I think they led academics around the world for the first time who already were not very forthcoming towards their Israeli colleagues, for the first time to tell the Israeli colleagues why they're not cooperating with this. And I think that has a lot to do with the students' movement. As for the recognition, I don't underestimate the importance of the recognition of Palestine. I think in this context, I mean, you know, if it happened 2 years ago, we would have said, yes, so what? They're recognizing the PA, they're recognizing Area A in the PA. You know, the historical context is always very important. The context of where we are now suddenly makes this recognition something that we think is very significant, not because of the PA, not because the PA is suddenly recognized as a real government or having a sovereign state, because the explanation that Spain, Norway, and Ireland gave is important, that the Israeli actions in Gaza pushed them and others to have this kind of idea. As you know, I don't support the two-state solution, so I'm not impressed by the fact that they connected to the two-state solution. But I think for many people in the world Palestine in the recognition is not necessarily the geographical space that the PA controls, or even a possible mini-state if Israel would ever allow it in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I think for many people, it means after 76 years of denial, finally the government say that Palestine exists, the Palestinians exist, they are the victims, they are not the criminals, and they deserve justice, and they deserve to be heard, and we should hear what they want and not all the time hear what the Israelis want. So I think there is, this is also very important, not just about isolating Israel, it's for the first time that two questions are being asked that haven't been asked before. Not is what is the future of the Palestinians, but rather what is the future of Israel. This is a question nobody asked. First time we're asking the question, what is the future of Israel? And secondly, for the first time, the Palestinians are asked about the vision for the future, and are not asked to respond to an Israeli peace plan. So this is all very, very cardinal, very unprecedented, and time will tell how it affects realities on the ground, but I think it has huge potential to do so.
Thanks, Ilan. Finally, I want to go back to the question I wanted to ask you first. So we see all these solidarity, all its solidarity, you know, all over the world that, you know, takes many forms. But what we've also seen, and this is why for me this is a moment of incredible clarity. You know, you know, it's important to count each other at some point. You know, who is with us, who is against us, and the repression and the censorship that has happened on social media, in university, at a diplomatic level, is also mind-blowing. I mean, when you see riot police going to attack students in universities in Switzerland, in France, in Belgium, in the US, when you see, you know, very violent pro-Israel mobs beating up peaceful pro-Palestinians with the police watching, the moment is incredibly clear. But in a way, repression and censorship takes many forms. And you have yourself, so you went to the US about 10 days ago. Mm-hmm. You flew to Detroit. And I guess at your surprise, or maybe not, you were detained and interrogated for 2 hours by federal agents. Could you, and I know you spoke about this quite a lot on Democracy Now! and things, but could you explain what happened again in a few minutes?
Yeah.
And why do you think this happened?
Yeah. Well, yes, I arrived in the U.S. and immediately taken to a small room on the side with two agents, which I should say were cordial, were not abusive, but they refused to tell me why they stopped me. And they had kind of two rounds of questions, one about my opinions on certain issues, such as the Hamas, the situation in Gaza, whether I think it's a genocide, and also about the slogan, Palestine should be free from the river to the sea. which I handled, I think, well, because I'm a teacher and I really used it. You know, I sort of looked at them as students who don't know anything. That was not so bad. I mean, it was not nice, but and it was cheeky. And I think, and more I hear from my lawyers in America, was also illegal in many ways. So we're still pursuing it, and we'll see what we'll do. They're not allowed, apparently. I was too tired to know that they're not allowed to ask these questions. In fact, what the thing is that I could have said, and I want a lawyer, but then I would have stayed for 9 hours in the airport, you know. So these, there's no easy way out of it. But what was really troubling was the second part of the discussion, so to speak, interrogation. One is that they asked for names of Arabs and Muslims in America that I know, asked me about several organizations, and that was very worrying for me. And then they took over my phone and copied everything in it, which, again, I wasn't sure whether they have the right to do it or not. But again, I understood that if I refused, you know, I'm delaying. And I waited quite a while for them to return the phone. And then they said that I have to wait until they make several phone calls. I don't know who they called. And eventually they let me go. I think that whoever is behind it, I'm not sure these two agents took a decision by themselves, of course, came from high above, is that there are two things which are important. And that's why I publicized it, because I think it will help many of my Arab American friends who feel that they are alone in these kinds of situation. And I hope that if we publicize these cases, the federal agencies will be a bit more careful with what they're doing. They have this narrative that professors of history or senior non-academics, which is really false, are behind the student movements. They come and they are the ones who instigate these kinds of actions, which of course is ridiculous. The students did not need us to do what they did. The second one is to deter you from coming back, you know, that you will think twice, because whoever thought that your coming to America is not good. Again, I don't have all the information. I must say, I don't know exactly if the Israelis pressured them or the pro-Israeli lobby, you know. I just finished a book, Lobbying for Zionism on Two Sides of the Atlantic, and I realized that AIPAC sometimes acts as a state by its own. I mean, AIPAC can take an action like this without even consulting Israel, you know. They're very powerful, and they think themselves very powerful, so they don't consult on anything with Israel. So they could be behind it. The idea is to deter you. You'll think twice if every time you come to the States. This is less important. I think what is important, to see it in the context, as you said rightly, it's part of the suppression. This is what happened to the rector of Glasgow University, Rassan Abusita, who was denied the entry to Germany and France. This is happening to a lot of other people who speak openly and courageously on Palestine. And especially they're targeting the people who are known to show that they can reach everyone. I mean, it's easy, of course, to target students, so on. And I think that's where they will fail, because people like us, I'm not saying we're immune. We're not immune from anything, and anything can happen to us. I'm fully aware of it. But I think that they are lost with ideas of what to do. Instead of, as I told these agents, I said to them, you know, just watch what's happening in Gaza, and you stop asking these questions. Maybe you don't know what's going on there. I said, forget Hamas, forget what do you care if I'm for one state or two states? Who cares? Why do you care? You are in Detroit. But don't ask why people are doing what they're doing. For God's sake, you know? And I think they were a bit embarrassed by my response to this. As I say, it's not their decision, you know, that they had to do this. But I think, yeah, it is worrying, because I kept saying to them, you don't stop professor of history for 2 hours for coming to give three lectures on history. I said, you lost your mind doing this. That is why I exposed it, as you write. I think you're right. It's a general suppression. The ordeal was not terrible, but it is shows that they have no limits when it comes to Israel. And this is important given what's going on the ground. So as much as the solidarity movement has swelled and increased, the counter movement is now taking off its gloves and will do all it can to kill the messengers because they cannot change the message. So if killing the messengers is stopping me for 2 hours in Detroit, it's not too bad, but I'm afraid they can do, not necessarily to me, but they can do, and they've already done, worse things to people in order to stop them. But it will not work, as you know, Frank. It will not work. None of us will stop saying what we are saying. None of us will stop writing what we are writing. We feel we are on the right side of history, and we'll do all we can to help the Palestinian in the struggle for liberation and freedom.
Thanks, Ilan. No better way to end. And yes, we will not stop until it ends. And I think, you know, being and knowing that you're on the right side of history is a very powerful impulse, you know. And so, yeah, thank you, Ilan.
Thank you, Frank. It was always great talking to you.
Thanks.
And hope to see you soon. Okay.
Same. Bye-bye, Ilan.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That was a conversation with the Israeli historian Ilan Pappé. He's now a professor at the University of Exeter in the UK. Frank Barat, the French activist, author, and film producer, spoke with him on May 26, 2024. You can find the full 29-minute talk on YouTube under the title Ilan Pappé, the US has no limits when it comes to Israel. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Wavefarms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Peter McPartland in Hudson, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. Robert McNeil, who died on April 12, 2024, at the age of 93, spent several years as a correspondent and news anchor for NBC, the BBC, and PBS before becoming the co-host of the PBS evening news show, originally the Robert McNeil Report and later the McNeil-Lehrer News Hour from 1975 to 1995. After he retired, he wrote novels and plays, as well as continuing to work in television. I interviewed Robert McNeil on June 25, 2003, in the KPFA studios while he was on tour for his memoir, Looking for My Country.
You've written memoirs before.
Yeah.
This one is a little different because you're trying to do something very specific here.
That's right. I'm trying to trace my kind of psychological journey from growing up in Canada with kind of confused loyalties, a mother who was obsessively Anglophile and equally obsessively anti-American, a spirit of the time in Nova Scotia where I grew up where we looked for our values to London before we looked anywhere else. But at the same time, like most Canadians' kids, I was consuming huge amounts of popular American culture, music, movies, radio programs, comic books, and so on, but not with very strong feeling of being Canadian. And like a lot of people growing up in small provincial towns, I wanted to go somewhere bigger, better, brighter, bigger horizons. And so I left Canada in 1955, but I didn't become a citizen here till 1997. And I kept asking myself, why did it take so long and what were the things pulling me various ways? This is an attempt to explain it.
Robert McNeil, let's go back a little bit into your book, Looking for My Country. You grew up in Canada, and as you say, you kind of didn't feel particularly Canadian. And I guess from the vantage point of Americans, we look at Canada and we go, yeah, that's a nice place. They don't have a lot of the extremism that we have, a lot of the crassness that we have. But from your perspective, looking down, you kind of must have felt like you were in Podunk, just out in the middle of nowhere.
Well, I did. But then the Canada of that time, when I was born in 31, so I graduated from high school in 1949. The Canada of that time, for a man with a certain amount of vanity and ambition to make a mark in the world, seemed like a backwater. There was no I wanted to be a writer. There was no Canadian literature to speak of. There was no professional theater to speak of. It seemed like somebody growing up in the most provincial town in America, and you wanted to get out of there. I came first to the States in 1952 at the age of 21. I had fancied myself as an actor in those days, to do a summer of stock in Massachusetts. And I just loved it. I loved all the openness and the generosity and the informality and the richer, in the sense of richer smells and odors and tastes, just a more a society that didn't seem to be as kind of white bread as ours was in Canada at the time.
But today, when we look at, and I've talked to people on tours, when they go from one city to another city to another city, every city looks the same, every restaurant is the same, and is that gone today?
You mean in the States?
Yeah.
No, I don't think that's true. I've just done a lot of traveling around many states, altogether about 19 states in the last few months, doing a documentary on language called Do You Speak American, including San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley. And I don't think that that's true. It's true that on the malls, the chains all look the same, whether they're clothing or restaurants or anything else. And there are branches of all those things in the downtowns, if they haven't been totally emptied out. But every city has its own flavor, I think, and still in this country, has its own kinds of restaurants, very different character. I mean, you certainly can't say that San Francisco's like every other city in the country.
Oh, no, there are three or four.
Or New Orleans, yeah. Or New York, or Chicago, or Detroit, or Pittsburgh. I don't think that's true. I don't think, and it's also, it's interesting because it's relevant to the story and documentary we're doing for PBS on language. A lot of people believe that broadcasting media are erasing all regional differences, making every American talk the same. Well, it ain't so. I mean, regional varieties, with a few exceptions, remain strong and in some cases even intensify as people want to resist the kind of homogenizing of American life due to the factors we've just discussed and want to assert their local identity more.
Robert McNeil, when you were in England, you had another view of the United States, or did you?
Yeah, I grew up with a kind of skepticism. I mean, I loved the experience of being in the States, but I ultimately, when I got my degree in Canada, decided to go to England and work. And then that's where I was trained as a journalist. And in that time, this is why I think my book is relevant to this time, I grew up with a kind of, as I became an adult and became a political creature, a kind of ironic distance on the States, admiring all the qualities for which the country is and should be admired around the world, but a little disdainful. For instance, I covered an awful lot of the Cold War, and part of one's sort of instinctive reaction in Europe was to be a little dismayed by the kind of messianic quality of some American leadership during the Cold War, to be absolutely appalled by the hysteria that allowed McCarthy, for instance, in the 50s to become the phenomenon that he was. And then, when other administrations came in, feeling much more relaxed. I mean, the first president I covered briefly the last 6 months of his presidency was John F. Kennedy, and Kennedy made not only Americans feel very good about this country, leaving aside the fact that some people hated him, but he made the world feel very good about this country. And all through the, and this is one of my points in the book, a foreigner, particularly the foreign press, but foreign political leaders, tend to see the United States as personified by the president and the policies of this particular moment. And I think this is happening right now. And therefore, you view the United States through the personality of this president of the moment as the kind of great Satan. Or you say, I hate what so-and-so's doing, so I don't like America. And in the hands or in the minds of people who have other motives, like Islamic terrorists, for a moment example, that can turn murderous. In the minds and in the mouths of people who are generally friends with the United States, it's nothing more than a kind of sardonic humor about, because they know that ultimately the righting moment will assert itself and the country will come back and reassert the values that make it so admired everywhere. But it took me a long time to learn, as I struggled with my own identity, what all my American friends knew all along, that any presidency is something of a phenomenon of that moment, and or 8 years at the most, and then things change and something else comes in, but the essential values of the country remain untouched.
Robert McNeil, over the years, when you were with NBC, later with PBS, and even now, you've met a lot of these presidents, and you've gotten, if not to know them, at least to see them firsthand. You can give a couple of capsule impressions of them.
The first candidate I covered was Barry Goldwater, extensively. And the first president I covered was John F. Kennedy. And then I covered Lyndon Johnson, extensively or intensively for a little bit, and so on. And what I gradually realized that each of these presidents was a kind of a sort of personal dramatization and exaggeration of certain aspects of the American character, which I was getting to know. So that Goldwater, for instance, was representative of that laid black Westernism, that kind of the aw shucks kind of thing, riled when riled, but not easily riled. That also, he represented that kind of impatience with too close study of details and a relying on intuitive and instinctive responses to things. That is very one side of American. Then you had Kennedy, this extraordinary, extraordinarily sort of aristocratic seeming, self-confident, handsome, articulate, witty, smart. All the self-confidence of his wealth and education, and he seemed to be a representative of something that many Americans would aspire to or would admire. Lyndon Johnson, coming up his hard scrabble way with a fiendish ambition and skills in manipulating other people politically, and with a great deal of idealism about the country, trying to kind of fulfill the unfulfilled agenda of his mentor and the man who inspired him, FDR, and so on through all these people. Johnson was certainly as manipulative with the press as any president ever. I can remember spending a few hours with him in Air Force One crossing the country during the 1964 campaign, and he had me and a reporter for the Associated Press back to the cabin and where he changed and sat us down. And then he sat down beside me and for about 2 hours began pounding me on my thigh as he emphasized the points that if we'd be good to him and he could be good to us and he could give us stories long before to impress our bosses because we'd have them long before anybody else. And then he proceeded to give us a whole list of stories and a whole list of issues that he was interested in. One was very interesting, because it's as relevant today, more so than it was then. He believed one of the great crises in this country could come from scarcity of water. As we moved more population and developed the arid parts of America, this was going to be, he said, it could be as great a crisis as a nuclear threat. And what he wanted to do, he said, as we looked down at the parched parts of the country, he said, if those Israelis, as he called them, those Israelis can desalinate the seawater, then, by God, we can do it, too. We just have to get the cost down enough, and I'm going to see that we do it. Anyway, Johnson a personality that just kind of came around you like a whirlwind, and you couldn't escape the force of that personality.
You mentioned Reagan was very distant, and you didn't get a chance to even get to know anything about him.
Yeah, well, now, to be honest, I never met Reagan.
Okay.
I always saw him from a distance. I was always in New York most of the time, but I did come and cover some of his campaign briefly in 66 when he ran for governor against Pat Brown. And Pat Brown made the mistake in California, of all places, in saying, remember, it was an actor that killed Abraham Lincoln, as though that somehow disqualified people voting for an actor. But I was just astonished observing Reagan, but really observing him as the country did on television, at how distant he seemed. And yet he clearly had and whether he developed it in his years in Hollywood or just had it instinctively in his own makeup, he had an uncanny ability to put his finger on things that touched the American heart. And he could employ this kind of Hollywood stereotypes of the sort of behavior that Americans really respond to.
When you say he put his finger on, and when we say that, do we mean he or do we mean the handlers?
Well, the handlers too, but it's since come out that Ronald Reagan wrote a great many of his own speeches and wrote them painfully, and that is painstakingly, I mean, by hand. There are some ones where a lot of other people have claimed credit. For instance, the speech that was written on the night of the Challenger disaster when he just moved the entire nation with the effectiveness of his short speech. That was written by Peggy Noonan. And on that kind of occasion, he was marvelous at delivering. And he could switch from strident, harsh, tear down that wall, Mr. Gorbachev, to, you know, sort of husky and moved and everything. He had all the skills of an actor. And he was, in that sense, a great communicator, as he's given credit for. But this business of his distance, I mean, the Reagan White House spawned more instant memoirs by people who were in it, even while they were in it, and while he was still president, than anyone I can think of. Usually they wait until after he's gone. And many of those documented his relative distance and sort of amnesia on some subjects. Shimon Peres told me that the former Israeli prime minister told me that Reagan had assured him had told him about how moving it was to be at the liberation of a couple of the concentration camps in Germany, when in fact Reagan was in Hollywood and had done voiceover commentaries for films about the liberation. Anyway, all these people are extraordinary. People ask me, who is the most interesting president you've observed or covered? They're all fascinating because anybody who gets to be president of this country has got to be a pretty remarkable and interesting individual in some way or other.
You're listening to an interview with the late Robert McNeil, who died April 12, 2024, at the age of 93. It was recorded June 25, 2003, while he was on tour for his memoir, Looking for My Country. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
Robert McNeil, do you regret your decision to retire from McNeil Lehrer?
No. I had done it for 20 years. Before that, I'd done, for more than 20 years before that, I'd done daily and regular journalism. And I'd been in broadcasting even more years before that. And I'd never intended to be a journalist. I wanted to be a playwright and a novelist. And I thought, well, I still had some health. I was about to be 65 when I retired. And before I started drooling on the air, I wanted to spend my time doing my own thing, which has been writing books. I've done 3 books since I left there. I've done a play, which I've been working on. I've done some traveling, and I've been working on this documentary. So it's when you're a journalist, you got to fill your head up every morning with that stuff, because you can't function effectively, especially if you're running, as Jim and I were, and as Jim now does, a program for 5 nights a week. You've got to know what's going on. So you don't have the luxury of saying, I don't want to get up. I want to get up this morning, and I don't want to be bothered reading the paper or watching television. I want to fill my head up with my own stuff, and I just wanted that luxury.
When you were doing that, you said you had to fill your head up with all this stuff. What was your daily routine to stay on top of things? Because you did your own writing, which distinguishes you from a lot of broadcast anchorman?
There's very little writing on the news hour. I mean, the news summary is written by people on the desk, and it has to be because it involves lead-ins to bits of tape and all that sort of thing, and it's a technical exercise, although we would edit what was written for us, and we would do lead-ins to guests and that kind of thing. Most of the program is ad-lib interviewing, you know, except for the documentaries, which reporters in the field do. Well, my routine was to read a couple of newspapers in the morning, sometimes listen to the radio a bit, then go into the office, and then absorb myself, plug into the usually the AP wire, Associated Press wire, and then after the advent of all news television, starting with CNN, usually that was on with the sound off in the office. Most news organizations have that going now, and then you kind of see something happens, you turn up the sound, and if they take you there to a news conference or something, you absorb that. And then on the particular story you were going to do, I was going to do that evening, then I would read a file that had been prepared of pre-interviews with the guests or background information. Some of them were easier than others because when it's the current running story, you're pretty well up to speed. And when it's something more arcane, like, for instance, I would have to, if I were doing right now when they're doing this Medicare drug benefit proposal for Medicare, that's very complicated. I don't know how people are going to, older people like me, are going to understand it. I'm on Medicare now. I don't know whether I'll understand it. But if I were doing that, doing a discussion for the NewsHour, I would have to sit down and spend several hours reading a lot of material, really, to get that. And that's the way it worked.
When you were doing this day-to-day immersion, did you ever discover, and are there examples where suddenly, out of the blue, a trend that had been building that you had overlooked suddenly came to your consciousness full-blown?
I don't remember that. I do know that I think one of the glories of the NewsHour, if I may be immodest about it, was that it allowed you to think on the air and be surprised by an answer to a question or hear something you hadn't anticipated and follow that up. That's the case. I don't know whether trends come from usually musing. I mean, over a period of a week, you read all the editorials and you read the news and you watch news conferences and you hear what this person and that person is saying. I mean, one of the strange things about American politics, I guess it's politics around in any democracy nowadays, they all communicate through the media. And one person sends up a trial balloon and another one tries to shoot it down, and then the media go running around from one to the other, and it feeds on itself. And by listening to all that, you get a feeling after a while, hey, well, I really should follow that up. That's the way it's trending. That's the way I would get it. I'd get it through the pores.
Robert McNeil, you mentioned a second ago those shocks and surprises. Can you think of any offhand?
I can't. I can think of some shocks when, for instance, I interviewed a man who just absolutely froze on the air. It was the time when we were doing one subject for half an hour, and there were a lot of grain elevator fires happening mysteriously all over the United States. And we assembled the four leading national experts on this, and it fell to me to interview the first one. And so I said, what do you think is causing the all these grain elevators to catch fire? And the man was just frozen with fear. He sat there, and he could not move a muscle. And because I'd read the material, I was able to say after a few moments, well, is it that such and such, there's some dust in the air, and somebody did it? And he was still just so for three or four questions, he just sat there, and I kind of asked the question, then went sort of half-assed, answer it. And eventually he said a few words at the end, and then we switched to another guest. And he loosened up after that and apologized, but We had a lot of disasters like that. One of the ones I remember is, speaking of water again, somebody told us that there was great danger that the Ogallala Aquifer, which is a huge underground cavern of water under many of the plain states, was being dangerously depleted by all the irrigation of agriculture as it expanded Texas and elsewhere. So we got exercised about that, and we thought we'd do half an hour on that. And I asked the first guest on the program, when do you think this will become, this was about 1977, when do you think this will become a real crisis? And he thought for a moment, he said, about 2035.
you met Lee Harvey Oswald, you think.
Well, William Manchester thought. What happened was, after the shots were fired in Dallas, I was covering it for NBC. I got out of the press bus, and I ran up the grassy knoll. And when we went over the fence at the top and there was nobody there, I went looking for a phone, and the place that looked as though it might have a phone turned out to be the Texas Book Depository. And as I ran up the steps, not knowing it had anything to do with anything, a young man came out. I said, "Where's your phone?" And he said, "You better ask inside," and so on. Eventually, I got to Parkland Hospital. I reported all day. But much later, about a year and a half later, William Manchester was writing the book, The Death of the President. And he said he'd been over the ground minutely, second by second, and he was convinced that it was Oswald. I'd asked for a phone on the steps. That Oswald that evening had been interviewed by the Secret Service, and he told them that as he left the building, a young, blonde, crew-cut Secret Service man ran up the steps and asked him for a phone. Well, I was young, blonde, had a short haircut, a gray suit on, a White House press badge, and so Manchester concludes that Oswald mistook me for a Secret Service man. It's amusing, and it was rather weird, but much more important, I think, is what caused me to run up the grassy knoll. And what caused me to run was that other people, including policemen, were running up there. And, of course, one of the conspiracy theories about the Kennedy assassination is that there was a shot fired from the overpass up there. Now, no one has ever come up with any hard evidence to disprove the Warren Commission findings that Oswald did it alone. But that remains a question for me. Why would policemen run up there? Policemen who in Dallas, you'd think, would be quite used to hearing the echoes of gunshots off tall buildings. So,
Robert McNeil, you're obviously not retired in what you're doing. What do you plan to do after you finish this latest English documentary?
Well, I have two novels in the works. One is has a first draft, which completed, which needs a lot more work. Another one I've begun and I'm more interested in. I think I would like to try another play, too. The one I've done has had a workshop production, and we're looking for a venue in New York for it. So, but I have another couple of play ideas in mind. That and playing with my grandchild.
So you have no interest in, say, getting up on stage and being the stage manager in Our Town or something like that?
No, well, I think the stage is better not having me on it.
Robert McNeil, you're pretty optimistic that the ship will right itself. Do you see it happening in the next 2 years or over the next six?
I don't know. I'm not good at this kind of prognostication. I think it will depend. If there were several more serious terrorist attacks, such as we're warned about all the time in this country, I think the paranoia of Americans Americans would tend to become paranoid, and they would look to their government for even greater protection and would countenance efforts that in peacetime we would consider too intrusive and too limiting of civil liberties and so on. And if they continue to see through the election next year as President Bush and the Republican administration as the best defenders of this country from such acts, then it's more likely 6 years. But, you know, the Democratic Party has not exactly been a party of radical opposition in the last few years. I mean, they went along with the vote on giving the president the power to invade Iraq, because many Democrats, looking to their own political futures, were afraid that if they didn't, they'd be hung for or hanged for voting against the war, as they felt they were in 1991. But they haven't taken, it's only a few recently emerged Democratic presidential candidates who've begun to be really, propose really alternative policies. So I don't know how far, if righting itself is the correct image here, I don't know how far the ship will go back the other way. It isn't the whole center of gravity of American politics has moved to the right. And, of course, the media have noticed that and kind of moved with it in a way. So the so-called loyal opposition, which is essential in a democracy, has countenanced that move to the right to a large extent and hasn't been blowing the horns of alarm and the whistles of desperation about it. So I don't know how far back it goes. For instance, I think it is interesting that one of the fundamental premises of this country is a kind of spirit of egalitarianism, not to make people equal, but to assure them that they have an equal opportunity to make it. And if you look at the way income has favored sort of upper reaches of the society, changes in income or improvements in income, as opposed to the middle and lower reaches in the last 20 years or so, highly symbolized by the ratio of CEO pay to average workers' pay, which in 1980 averaged